Party Pod is brought to you by the book Ending Addiction for Good, which is by Cliffside Treatment Center founder and CEO Richard Tate and Dr. Constance Scharf, Cliffside's addiction researcher. Through self-disclosure, case studies, scientific facts, and firsthand experience, Tate and Scharf explain how anyone can recover from addiction. The book is great. I'm a fan of it. And I'm not the only one. It's received rave reviews, and it made it into the VMA's gift bag. And you just know those people need to hear this message. You can get the book on Amazon, of course, or by going to their website, which is cliffsidemalibu.com. Hey guys, it's Anna. Yeah, whoa. The microphone just did a weird thing. That's kind of what happens when you have high-tech recording studio like I do. Anyway, hi, missed you. Are you all okay with this, like, every other week thing? Because, yeah, the workload, it was getting to be crazy. And plus, I started to worry that I was going to run out of sober alcoholics if I kept up with this crazy, you know, 52 episodes a year, because I think long-term like that. Anyway, so we switched to bi-monthly. You know something I heard, and I have no idea. I could Google it. You could Google it right now, because I can't Google it because I'm talking to you. But bi-monthly apparently means both twice a month and every other month. I mean, someone told me that a long time ago, and it was so long ago that there was no Google, so I didn't go check it, and I've been sort of repeating it as fact ever since. So I don't know if that's true, but anyway, this podcast is now bi-monthly, and I mean every other week, not every other month. And, you know, write me if you know the answer to that. We'll have a little interaction going. Maybe I'll even talk about it in the next podcast. Anyway, today's guest, was so interesting. He's a guy named D.H. Peligro, and you know him as the drummer from the Dead Kennedys. He was also in the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And he has lived a crazy, crazy life, because you sort of get used to around these parts hearing, you know, people tell stories and, you know, you stop being shocked. You start regularly hearing in sobriety stories about, yeah, you know, it's like I died and, you know, I died for a few minutes. I overdosed. They cut off part of my body because it was gangrene because of shooting into it. This was a story that kind of, I've never actually heard anything this bad. He has a new book out. It's called Dreadnought, King of Afropunk. And you should get this book. It's a crazy story. So the guy has been to rehab, he estimates 30 times, maybe 31. And what I didn't know when I reached out to him is that he's actually in treatment now. He's getting out. He will be out by the time you hear this. But I interviewed him while he was getting out of treatment, like, the next day. And you know, he's really honest about his struggles with this disease. You know, he comes from a lot of trauma. And you know, and he says that he hadn't completely dealt with it, and it started to come up, and now it sounds like he's in therapy and he is dealing with it, because obviously trauma and addiction are so very connected. And you know, he and I get into this in this episode, but you know, it's not something that even when I went to treatment, which was, you know, a little over a decade ago, they didn't really get into that, and in a way that I don't think that was being emphasized in treatment the way it is now. And I think it's a great thing, because a lot of sober people I know suffered incredible trauma as children. So he talks about that. He talks about joining those two iconic bands. He talks about the part of his body. This is a really disgusting, not safe for work part where he talked. I made him do it, but it repulsed me. I say that with a lot of affection. He's an amazing guy. But it's like he's talking about, like, parts of his body, like, leaking out and surgery where he wasn't really knocked out because he had the super high tolerance. So he saw, like, pus being squeezed from his body onto the walls of the hospital. I mean, Jesus. You know, living with these, like, crazy people in San Francisco, moving to LA and being on some, you know, on a bus, kind of living on a bus. And then moving into Jane's room of, you know, Jane's addiction in Perry Farrell's house. And And all the different rehabs and lives, you know, he has led. And he brought his lovely lady. I didn't inquire. I got the feeling she was his lady. She came. Her name is Garuda. That's not her birth name. She talks about it. We interview her. This is a two-parter. I didn't ever get. I meant to ask and I forgot what her, you know, name she was given before she gave herself the name Garuda. But I hope you enjoy this episode. I think you will. I think you should buy his book, Dreadnought, King of Afropunk. You can get it on Amazon. And thank you for listening. Later. I'm so sorry. We're here. House Calls with Laura House.
House Calls.
We had a little recording issue.
Oh.
Yeah. Laura says these amazing things and then
everybody's safe. It's okay.
Screw it up. Oh, God, if only we captured what you just said.
What about the phrase, beat yourself up? Maybe stop doing that.
That's not an expression.
Oh, really?
It's not an AA expression.
Oh.
No, it is.
It's just a world expression. Don't beat yourself up about it. It certainly gets said a lot in there because everybody's doing it.
The one that we screwed up, let's be honest, I screwed up the recording. We were talking about belly button birthday. And what were you saying? Recapture it for us, please.
It's a silly thing to say, but I like it because to go 365 days and nights, that makes me laugh, but without having a drink of alcohol becomes a much bigger deal
than your actual birthday.
I just didn't die.
Yeah.
So it is kind of interesting where it's like, oh, it's my birthday. Oh, how exciting. Well, it's my belly button birthday. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I think it kind of becomes that, which I would think would sound ridiculous.
And so worth mocking if you didn't.
We can't talk about it to other people. Yeah, we cannot talk about it to other people. They would just be like, that is like, it just seems so weird. But I just say like, so my my belly button one is in March and it's just become so inconsequential because I look to July. Like, am I going to make it to another July?
Right.
The other one.
But also, it kind of, yeah, I do, I like to do a little karaoke party on mine.
Oh, boy.
On my soberversary. That's what my sponsee calls it.
Soberversary. Yeah. All right, nice word blend.
Yeah. I could have gotten your reaction to that.
But soberversary. Well, it hasn't really taken off yet. She'll be lonely 10 years from now going, I said soberversary first. Oh.
No, she invents expressions left and right and doesn't want credit for it.
Is she young? That's a young people thing. No, they're always inventing
she has
words.
New York-iversary.
That's too much.
You know what? There's a story in the post about her.
It's Unnessa.
You know what?
that's
Don't try to be like her.
It's Unnessa.
You want me to sponsor you? That's really what this is all about. This is in Huskals, not a house. Oh, my God. So this is a totally exciting morning over here at the After Party Pod Studios, right?
Right.
I have an actual rock star in the vicinity next to my cat. Yeah, sort of next to my cat.
What's his name? Cookie Puss?
Okay, no. Look who has not been paying attention to
Toby. I know that's Toby. I know that's Toby and that's Lionel.
I'll give Lionel. You $10,000 to say her name. And you had the right first. Oh, come on, cheating. If you cheat, you have to pay me $10,000.
Oh, well, you know, you didn't say that disclaimer just yet.
No. Here, I want you kind of close to the mic.
Get close to the mic.
Should I tell everybody who you are?
Spread my legs open.
Okay, don't listen. You know, no profanity into
no
my
profanity.
microphone.
No profanity. No, did I say something wrong?
I had to
get my legs around the corner of the table.
Let's turn his mic off. I'm kidding. Yeah. No, this is DH Peligro.
You should see Anna David just blushing right now.
I don't blush. It's a terrible thing
what?
About...
Me neither. Crazy.
I really don't. No? I used to.
I sweat. I tend to sweat.
Oh, interesting.
I'll say something really embarrassing, and then I'll just sweat. People go, why are you sweating? I'm like, oh, I got high blood pressure, bad breath, BO and zits, and so I'm sweating. I'm just sweating.
That's a great
It's good
answer
for your skin,
anything.
Though.
Yeah, you know? No.
It's
that's
better
why,
than the
that's,
truth.
After all the hard living you've done, that's why your skin is so glowing
hard
and clear.
Living. The hard living.
That is some hard living.
Are you talking about my book, the book?
I'm talking about your book, which happens to have been about your life.
It is about my life. It's the autobiography of my life, and there was some hard living. When I read Dreadnought, King of Afropunk, which is the name of the book, by the way, sometimes I can't believe it's me. I'm like, I cry because it's just so touching, and it's my story, and I went through it, and now on the outside looking in, what was I thinking? How crazy was it? Just seemed to be commonplace, and it seemed to be just a thing to do, and to try to get over this hurdle, we're going to do this and go this way and zig-a-zag, you know, and catch the chain gang up to Chino or however, whatever. Right, there's right. So
it
many
logical
different stories.
In some crazy way.
Right. And, you know, it just took all that for me to get to where I am now. So I guess illogically it kind of makes sense because it took me on the path that I went on.
It's really honestly the most insane path I've ever heard of. You know, it's like we were talking about Jerry Stahl before, but it's like, and I, you know, because I do this work, I hear crazy stories. And plus I'm sober, you know, a while. And so I hear crazy stories. I've never, because this is like, if you heard 19 crazy stories, and then you put them all together, then it would be the introduction to your book.
Right. The
like, I mean, it's like you basically should have died. 100 times.
Not sooner. Yeah.
And you're sitting here vibrant, healthy. How long are you sober?
I'm sober. I got 24 hours.
Okay, that's not acceptable. The cat. Hold on. You keep talking.
I'm sober.
You're sober.
I'm sober.
That is how much control my cats have, basically. She walked over a keyboard.
Uh-huh.
Because this is a very high-tech studio where cats are my assistants.
We're like on top. Just so you guys know, we're on top of the Capitol building and Nat King Cole's old room.
Yeah. I mean, don't tell them because we have stalkers.
Oops.
Maybe.
Sorry.
If you knew how fancy these are, you know, this recording studio was. But basically, my cat decided she wanted to be a part of the thing, so she stepped on a key of the keyboard that made my voice start coming out of the computer.
I saw her doing that. Yeah. I was like, I thought she was going to knock with the phone. Lily?
She's smart. She's as smart as
she
I am.
Wants to be
and
involved.
She doesn't have command of the English language yet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, we have another special guest here because we have Garuda. Hello. Come say hi, Garuda.
Hello.
I got a lovely treat when DH walked in with this lovely woman who immediately, took to my cats. And, you know, obviously you're in my heart for life when that happens.
And
she's so lovely. And I want you to explain this thing that you were just telling me about your name and how you changed it because it's fascinating.
Okay. Well, I'm sober as well. And like so many of us do, we want to avoid the things that actually help us stay sober. Mm. So one of the things I did is I explored all these different spiritual paths. And one of the positive things I got out of that is my name, which is Garuda Love. And one of the things that they taught us, which I do agree with, is that your name is like a mantra because you identify with it. You associate yourself with your name and you are associated by that with everyone. You sign your name, you hear yourself called by that name infinite times through your life. So the logic is have a name that embodies an intention of who you want to grow into, who you want to be. So Garuda is a bird deity in Hindu tradition, in many forms of Buddhism. And in Buddhism particularly, that's the Garuda I connect with. There are many different forms of Garuda. In the Shambhala Buddhism, the Garuda represents the quality of outrageousness, the wisdom, the freedom, just the power to be who you really, really are, as wild and crazy as that is, because your mind is uncluttered with bullshit.
Ah,
that's been cleared out.
That's what I want.
Yeah, exactly what we all want, and I need that. And my teacher realized I needed that. And Garuda is also a warrior, a protector of the body, very fierce energy. And so, you know, as an addict, we're all fierce and intense. And when we sober up, we can use that energy for positive things.
Protector of your body or my body?
Garuda Love.
Yeah,
both.
I know.
Everyone's
body.
Everyone's
body.
So you came here and you were protecting his body, and now you're also protecting mine.
Protecting yours, mine, and Kitty's. Mm-hmm. And also, I just had to put my kitty down 2 days ago.
Sorry.
And there's also an aspect of Garuda that represents, at the moment of physical death, a person reaching enlightenment. At the precise moment the body expires. And so I had that in mind with my kitty cat because I think they all have souls. And I was just,
there with it,
praying for it. And but so the last name given to me was Love. So that all that fierce la, 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 comes from a place of love.
Garuda Love in the house.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. And she's going to bring all of that to this podcast, lucky us. So let's go back to
the party podcast.
Okay. So first I'd love to hear about how the book came about. Tyson Cornell, who's the greatest man ever.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you come to have him publish it?
I was running around from person to person and trying to get these, you know, after years, it took like me, it's like 6 years to really write this book, right?
Yeah.
And
you really wrote it. Nobody else wrote it.
Yes. Yes. I really wrote it. I had to, you know, and I've never written a book before. So it was like, do I know what I'm doing? Is this right? And, you know, and I just kept plugging away at doing it. So it, you know, with a little bit of editing, which they call killing your babies, it kind of like ticked me off because I wanted it all to be in there, Anna David. I wanted it all,
so
Anna
more?
David. There's a lot. There's some more. There's maybe 120 more pages or something.
The thing is, it is a long book. I will say it is.
Is it?
Yeah.
Is it long?
Yeah.
I've read longer.
I mean, that's
I've seen longer. I've seen bigger.
I mean, it's
Anthony Kiedis' book is
shorter. I've read that book.
It's shorter.
I think
so. It's 460 something pages.
Are you sure about that?
I am pretty sure about that.
When I'm turning in a book, they always say aim for 300.
Aim for 300, okay.
So we got 65 extras
here.
But no, I mean, it's an intense, crazy, crazy story. I mean, how many times in treatment in all?
I'd say about 31 treatments. I mean, you know, now when I say treatment, I count all the methadone clinics and trying to kick on methadone detoxes,
right,
and outpatient clinics where they give you loads of drugs and, right, you know, like they say, like, well, take these at this time and take these at this time of day, and then it's like when you're crawling out of your skin, I just take it all at once, and
that's how
I crash some cars,
right?
And
is that like Suboxone, you mean?
No, this is way before Suboxone. It was like some methadone, I mean, an outpatient clinic in Glendale. We found, me and my girlfriend at the time, Sherry, we found it, and they just will give us like a packet.
Yeah.
Pack these packets.
And what are they? Stuff. They're opiates?
It was like a Visceral Clonidine, Robaxin, and just, you know, mild, just very mild stuff that, you know, if you're a full-blown
amateur
junkie,
shit.
It's like, yeah, it's not really going to, it didn't do a damn thing.
But if you took it right now, you might pass out on the chair, right? And was it finally Cry Help was the one that you, that finally
Cry
got
Help
you
was,
clean?
Cry Help was one of the ones. I did get about 2 years after I came out of there. Two or three years. Maybe I'm getting it mixed up because I've been to Cry Help 5 times.
Yeah.
So, I actually went down to this one in Georgia, and I got sober down there. And here's something new for you, Anna.
Yeah.
I went to Brazil, and I had a slight little relapse.
Yeah.
And, I'm in a place right now. I'm leaving on Saturday. I'm in a place called Community Recovery right now.
Oh, my God. Oh, so, okay. Yeah. So, wow.
Breaking news.
Breaking, because I was just about to say, like, oh, how many years? So, but you seem certainly not like the guy described in this book.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. With my bouts in and out of sobriety, there's always something else that needs to be uncovered. Something I haven't learned. Something I haven't dealt with. Something that's deep, so suppressed or repressed that I just haven't gotten to it or won't even let it come up.
And so it comes up, and you get scared, and you use.
Well, what happened this time is I let it come up, let it be exposed, just let myself be really vulnerable to everybody. I didn't care who was watching, what the hell's going on. You know, I just let it all up and expose it all to, like, you know, that I never dealt with therapists.
You'd
like
never
I never really went, you know.
Right.
So we have like therapy and like these constellation groups and all this family stuff that.
So are you in treatment right now?
I am right now.
In outpatient or in inpatient?
I'm in inpatient.
Where do you, we shouldn't say where. I mean, that's private. But wow.
If you want me to, I will.
I mean, like,
I don't know if that's.
Yeah, who knows?
I'm leaving Saturday anyway.
You're leaving treatment on Saturday. So you've been there like 25 days or something?
I've been there for nearly 3 months.
Wow. Okay.
It'll be 3 months. It'll be 90 days.
Okay, on Saturday.
That's our sober lingo, 90 days. Yeah.
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 Are you taking chips and stuff like that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you're doing the whole thing.
I didn't want to. And some lady, intervention lady, said that, you're not taking those chips for you. I was like,
Yeah.
Good point. Good point. And so I just went up, you know, I did it all. And, you know, people, either you find the people who really love you and are really there no matter what.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or the people who are just kind of like surface fair weather friends who are just like get really scared. And I understand both sides. Yeah. It's like, you know what?
Maybe. How long were you sober when that happened?
2.5 years, I think. Mm-hmm. I think it was. Three and a half. I'm sorry. Three and a half years.
And then something came up, not in therapy. It just kind of came up. Mm-hmm. And I want to make sure I get it, like where you got exposed or what you were talking about with that. Because I think that's so important.
Yeah, it is important. I was in Brazil and we were touring, and I'm usually all right once I have, if I'm, have a responsibility to you know, like gigs, you know, and I have to be there and I have to do these interviews and I have to do all, whatever I'm doing. But I'm cool. And then, like the tour was over, everybody was going to stay there one day and go home. And I was like, oh, I'm going to go hang with my friend for a couple of weeks.
Bad idea.
It's like, yeah, it was bad. And I was like, hey, man, I need to get to a meeting. Hey, man. And he's dealing with his kids and his wife and his job, and he just can't get me to a meeting out of David.
Right. But you could have gotten yourself.
Right. I could. Well, it's a little bit tougher. It's, speaking Portuguese my broken Portuguese needs some help. And, you know, I had internet access if I would stay in this one area.
Right.
Like near the kitchen sink.
Right,
and
right.
it was really tough. But I had talked to my sponsor and all this kind of stuff. I was doing whatever I could. But I said, Chris, look, man, I got to get to a meeting. I don't care if it's Portuguese. I have to get to a meeting. He didn't get me to a meeting. And so we went to Rio de Janeiro and hung out with these crazy skater kids. And they were one night they decided to get some coke. And they were sniffing coke. And I was like, told the other guy, let me have some of that. Meanwhile, he'd given us some rupees. Roofies, like a date rape drug. So to sleep, that's just the equivalent of their black market. Like,
so
they don't have all the stuff we
have. You'd already taken a roofie.
I'd already taken one.
Right. So you'd already gone out by the time you saw the coke.
But
you didn't think that way.
I didn't really. I was like, it's just like sleeping. I gotta go to sleep. I find it hard to sleep in a room full of people.
But like, and most people probably like take a roofie and don't wake up for like 3 days, right? I've never been roofied.
Roofie raped.
But you've, you roofied yourself and you slept.
And I went right to sleep, yeah.
Yeah. And so then you did the coke and there was no one around.
No, I didn't do the coke.
Oh, okay.
I didn't do the coke.
Okay.
I asked them and the guys were pretty protective. They were like, no, roofies are not really considered a drug.
Yeah.
So they ended up, they were like, no, don't give the age any coke. It's crazy. He won't get out of the country. He's fucking crazy. Don't fucking give him anything. So they didn't.
Right.
And I came back here and I shared about it to some people. And I was like, so the mental obsession had already been, had started the wheels turning and, you know, released the phenomenon of craving.
Yeah,
you know?
That's so real.
Yeah, it was a real thing. It was a real thing. And I went downtown and I just went, and I smoked some crack, like, which is not usually what I would go for first.
Right.
Put some crack and then smoked some more crack. And then I got some heroin and crack. And then it just spread out throughout a month. And you know, and I couldn't hide it, or nor did I want to hide it or detain it anymore. Well, the beautiful thing about it is that people from, you know, the place we go. Do I say the name?
I let people say it if they want to, and they don't have to if they
people,
don't want to.
People who love me just called, and they were they called me. Hey, what's up? What are you doing, man? What's going on with you?
I haven't seen you. Right.
Did
you tell them when you were that month? You were just staying away from it. You know, when you were using, were you telling
anybody? No, I wasn't really strong. Strung out.
Right.
Strung like a Stradivarius, strung like a Stratocaster. I wasn't strung out yet.
And so, what did Garuda know?
When did Garuda know?
Well, I could detect a change when he was in Brazil.
Right.
I could tell, like, he's usually a pretty easygoing guy. Like, he's definitely got temper issues to work with, you know, like I do too. But, you know, I could just tell he was irritated a lot. And I was thinking to myself, God, he's fucking dry. And I, you know, I do Al-Anon as well. And, you know, I took my suggestions there, and it's like, okay, Garuda, stay out of it. This is his. You know, he's got to do what he's got to do. And I would just say, like, hey, babe, have you gone to a meeting? And he's like, no. And you know, I was like, okay, all I can do is pray. And when he came back, I still noticed he wasn't quite the way he normally is. He's usually really dependable and loving. And the loving was there, but the dependability was dwindling. And then I just noticed he sounded a little different on the phone. And we had the same drugs of choice. So, you know, I knew. And one day we were supposed to go to a meeting. And he's like, oh, babe, I'm not going to go. And I was just like, okay, I'm walking over to his house. And I walked over, and he was high on the couch. But again, it's like I work my program. Right. It's like I'm not going to come at him like, yeah, what did you do? You know, I just sat down. I was like, hey, baby, I've noticed this, this, and this. Did you go out, honey? And he was very honest.
Yeah.
And he was like, yes, I did.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he talked to his sponsor, went to some meetings, let everyone in his
circle,
yeah, his man support circle know. And yeah, you know, to varying degrees, like some people, like he said, you know, couldn't physically be there, but people called all the time. I took suggestions again and worked my own both programs around it, and I was like, okay, I can physically be there. And if I find it's too hard to be, then I will leave, go to a meeting, and then come back when I can. And I let him know that like, you know as an addict myself, I can't make somebody stop.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I'm not going to try, be there to the extent that I can. And fortunately, it was, I could handle a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I said, and, you know, when I can, I won't be. But you know, I'm always here when you're ready to be clean again. And you, if you need help, I'm here. And your men are there, and you know what to do, and we've got you. We're behind you when you're ready. And so I really tried not to pressure. Like, sometimes I failed, you know, and I made amends. But
did you fail? Not very often, huh?
No. What, first pressure?
Yeah.
Pressure me?
Yeah.
No, I don't even care. I was just like, whatever I'm doing.
Yeah.
That's kind of like, yeah. Yeah. It's too late now. You can't save me.
But then, and then you said, okay, I'm ready to check in somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, it was a little bit, it was premature. Some guys from my band came over, from my band Peligro came over, and they were like, they made a bunch of phone calls because we're all dialed in and we know these guys.
Yeah, Map, they're calling up Map again.
They're calling this other guy. He's got the place in Malibu. And
they're
like, well, you're going over to Hollywood Detox. And I was like, it was kind of like, I knew that I wasn't ready, but I just went to just, save face and lose ass, you know. So, I just went. Yeah. And, you know, shut them up. And I knew I had some stuff coming up that I wanted to be present for, available for. Yeah, there. And, yeah, responsible.
Yeah.
And so I just went, and it was like a 10-day detox. And it was, I end up leaving there the day I left there. Now, I did finally get Subutex, Suboxone, whatever it is.
Yeah.
I had to, Suboxone.
So they, at detox, they put you on Suboxone.
Yeah, but I think they dosed me down. The last day, I was still dosing off of Suboxone. Mm-hmm. And I went home, and I was pretty sick the next day. And I was just
supposedly, it's harder to detox off than heroin.
Yes, well, that's what they say. I don't think so. I mean, I haven't been on it for any long period of time, like years, you know.
Right, maybe. But they also took you down.
Yeah, they take you down. They dose you down. But
your treatment center won't allow you to be on it. Or they will.
Oh, no. When I went there, I started out, on Suboxone. Yeah. And I got dosed down every week until it was like 1 milligram. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. And I think I need more. And I got like an extra day.
Right.
Once you're off it sucks, but it's not nearly as bad as kicking cold turkey or just anything like that.
But also treatment centers are putting people on Suboxone and keeping them on Suboxone for life.
For a long time, yeah, for a long time, yeah.
Yes.
For life, yeah. It's horrible. Because they want to keep getting that money, some of them cats, man. They do it for the money and not for the love of doing the thing to help another person in need to deal with their problem. A lot, you know, fortunately, the place I'm at, they don't do that. They, you know, if you're not done in a month, it's like... if you're on methadone or something, you've been on it for like 5 years or something, sure, they're going to take a couple of months or 3 months to dose you off of it. But But, you know, if you're just off the streets just doing junk for a while, they don't care if it's a few years. It's like, yeah, they want to dose you down. They really want you to get better.
Yeah.
You know, they really want you to get better. They kind of, they care a little bit more than, like, some places are there for the paycheck, there for the $50,000 or whatever they're getting. And I've heard some horror stories of, like, people, clients being able to just go and get their own meds.
Oh, yeah.
Like, what? Like, they have the keys to the med cabinet?
I know. Well, there was all this stuff that went down with the 180, that place.
Yeah. That might have, well, yeah. Stuff.
Yeah. No. I mean, it's a really, it's like, you know, it's like somebody was saying to me the other day, an addiction doctor, it's the Wild Wild West. It's Boomtown.
Yeah.
So these treatment centers are making up their own rules.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and.
I mean, who they fucking have to answer to?
And, you know, and I think, and their argument with the medication is, well, there are some people who are never going to be able to do the AA thing. They're never going to be able to be totally clean. And maybe that's true. Maybe. But the fact that they're going to that as a first option rather than as a last resort is, I think, what's scary, you know? Mm-hmm. I would love to kind of go chronologically, you know, way back at, you know, I loved the book. I didn't say that yet.
You're
an alcoholic, you're going to notice if I didn't say that. She didn't say she loved the book. I never heard her say that. I loved the book. Well, I could not put it down.
Thank you. I loved it too.
It sounds cavalier to even talk about, you know, there was a lot of trauma as a kid. A lot of trauma. Mm-hmm.
That's some of the issues that I hadn't dealt with either. Yeah. You know? Like, I may, like, brushed on the surface and, like, said something about it at this place or that place. And some places don't even deal with that. They don't even deal with it. They don't even, you know.
Well, I do think that that's something, treatment is evolving. I think that people, you know, in the recovery, you know, industry are now aware of the intense connection between trauma and addiction.
It really affects your life and for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
If you don't deal with it, and even if you do deal with it, it's an ongoing process.
Yeah.
It's something you have to just really recognize. Like me, I got beaten as a child a lot. I got in a lot of fights. I got, my family was dysfunctional, and I had an alcoholic father.
Yeah.
Right, who would do savory things like stick guns in my face.
Your stepdad,
right? And now, even when I'm in arguments, my senses are heightened and I'm aware, and sometimes I almost sort of stop breathing. Like, you know, it's like kind of a fight or flight thing, and you're just ready, and and that all just stems from my traumatic childhood.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, if you sort of subscribe to the Freudian, you know, which I do, which is like basically everything. I'm always saying this, like every podcast I talk about this, turn, you know, fast forward, you guys, if you're sick of it, but you know, everything important happens from 0 to 7, everything.
Yeah.
And so we spend from 8 to 89 or whatever, trying to undo, if we suffer trauma, mm-hmm. undo what happened in those years. Cause it's like, you know, so yeah, you learn as a kid, somebody's sticking a gun in your face as a regular thing, you better have, you know, your body gets flooded with the endorphins or whatever. Not endorphins is the wrong word, you know, to fight that off.
Yeah.
And so then when you get triggered to anger later, that floods your body again.
Mm-hmm.
That's the least scientific explanation ever.
Yeah, and even...
sleep.
No, it's not the least scientific. I understood it.
As a child, it makes it hard to sleep.
Yeah. Man. I have such sleep issues.
I don't sleep very well.
Yeah.
That's why I took the roofies.
Exactly. Well, the thing is, I had a big Ambien thing, and I never thought of it as a drug. I was like, I need Ambien. What are you talking about? Like, I need to sleep, you know?
Yeah.
But okay. And you got out of there fast. Like as a kid, you were only
17, yeah.
And you went off to San Francisco.
Right.
My hometown, by the way.
Oh. I lived
in
this. What?
What?
Bam.
Yeah, okay, we got to stop too. Bam. I'm from Marin. So, no, I'm not like you.
Oh, you're not hella bad?
Yeah, no, I'm cool. So not part of hella, like not, what you just city? Thought when you from slashed
city?
Me.
No. Oh.
No, I'm from Marin. I lived in Cal Hollow.
One of those pretty untouchable girls, like, if I could just get with her. I'd be across the Golden Gate Bridge, and in I'd be Marin. Away from this hellhole and this madness where the people are keeping me down, and all this homeless, disgraceful vagabonds making my life a living hell.
you could say it like
and then
that.
You just walk away and you go.
No, or you could say you were like, you know, it like where San Francisco was happening and I was like in the marina. And it, you know what I mean? Like having a beer with like a guy in a fraternity sweatshirt. You know what I mean? Like that was my scene in San Francisco.
Okay, that's
Does that help?
No, I mean if we want to compare low bottom stories, yeah.
No, that my bottom.
I think I would win.
Yeah, no, I think you'd beat anybody. I mean, you beat anybody. I would never enter that competition. But it when I moved to LA, it got uglier. It definitely got uglier. Right. But
well,
it
just
always
does.
Yeah, exactly.
It can always get uglier.
There was rules to punk rock, and we weren't allowed to do such things.
What do you mean?
Like, we weren't allowed to hang out with guys with fraternity sweaters.
No, of course not.
We weren't supposed to be allowed to smoke pot. We weren't allowed to, like... only wear certain clothes, which all these fucking uniform things came
with. Why couldn't you smoke
pot? Because it was for hippies in San Francisco. Like, you know, I kind of grew up in the Haight Ashbury sort of thing. It was still sort of a left overture from the fucking 60s and 70s. Yeah. And there were still people around like, Jerry Garcia's got me! You know, and they were like in a permanent acid psychosis. And I would hang with some of them because I was kind of like, didn't have a job, ain't got nothing to do, you know. I don't really know that many people, and I had some jobs, but it was like I had a lot of free time, so I would hang out in Hippie Hill in the park and playing drums and taking lots of acid and smoking lots of weed. So that was commonplace for me.
Yeah.
But you know, and then you know, you get in the punk. I got in the punk rock world, and it was like nobody in the bands I was with was saying that, except Jello Biafra would kind of give you like these, like, we don't drink beer at rehearsal.
Right. Like, it's not like, hardcore? Is that like...
Huh? What? Like,
right.
Is this like a... It was like, no. We can wax philosophical about politics for 3 hours and not even touch an instrument, but we don't.
Right. No beer, no pot.
And he was dead set against like that hippie because he came from Boulder, and Boulder was another hippie town.
Yeah, for sure.
Hippie. So.
So okay, and then okay, so you moved in with pretty quickly with this like Pearl and Linda.
Pearl and Linda, yeah.
So and that was just crazy, like coke, like, and they were like
coke, and I never seen gay people before in my life. Oh, and, yeah. I mean, and like Pearl was flaming. Honey had a big honking Jewish nose, and he was had this curly hair, and he had these bracelets, and they would like jingle around, and he did these impersonations of Janis Joplin, and he was the Janis Joplin. That was his act. He was the Janis Joplin
impersonator.
Right. Yeah, right. Okay. And I didn't figure this out till years later.
Wait, which that, part that he
that,
was
that he was that he was a gen that he was doing Janis Joplin. I was just I don't know what I was thinking. I was thinking probably about Judas Priest or something. But
this is when also the drugs like really kicked in.
This
you.
Was the kind of the, sort of the introduction.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the liquid LSD and the eyeballs and the sugar cube acid, and they had coke. When Linda would come home, she'd play with herself in the chair, and it was really like
an education.
I'd never seen anything. I never, ever seen anything like that.
Right.
And it was pretty graphic. Did I do a good job of explaining it in the book?
Yeah, the book is graphic.
Did you?
Like,
yeah.
Because it's got like the weather.
Did you have any feelings?
Yes.
Were you, yeah.
Oh, well,
I'm asking because
interviewing who? Let's get that straight. No, okay. I'm kidding. I just felt
well, how
put
did
on
that
the
make
spot.
You feel?
No, I told you I couldn't put it down, and you know I read it in like three. I only read it at night. It's like a weird thing. I don't read during the day. Like I read it in like three nights.
Me too.
And did you write it in 3 nights? I'm kidding. Hardly.
Yeah.
But because also I'm from San Francisco, so some of it, you know, was familiar and yet wholly unfamiliar to
what? People tell me that about St. Louis, and the guy who wrote the foreword, Bill Needlesetter, he was like from St. Louis as well, and, you know, we were both born there, but his world in St. Louis was a lot different than my world. He was like, you know, they're just completely like...
Yeah, it's like a different city.
Yeah, different. But I mean, somewhere I get the feeling in San Francisco, somehow we would have like... I would have maybe saw you on the Bard or...
Yeah.
I would have like, hey, like...
No, I got a I really got to emphasize how uncool I was. But I wasn't the icon of coolness that you see sitting before you with the chats now.
She's cool. She's cooler than the polar bear's toenails all up in Antarctica.
I just, you know, when you don't know yourself at all, you know, it was like, I thought that like going to the blue light on Union Street was like, I would find my people. Like, you don't even know what that is. Right. You've never even like,
you know what? I worked at the, I worked on Union and Grove.
I don't know Grove.
No?
No, because I was talking like Pacific Heights, like that, like
Union Van Ness,
like the bars,
the Sun Grove, was
See, that was again a cool neighborhood. I was not in those.
It was a ritzy neighborhood. I just worked there, and then I had to leave, and we got fired because I took some acid one night and I ate some sausage, and I'd already been a vegetarian, and this threw up, and the sausage came out of my nose.
Okay, that's what I'm gonna grab.
Is that too much?
No, I'm really.
I could taste it. I could really taste it too. Yeah.
And then
me and Eddie fell asleep, and then they called us sleeping on the job, and we got fired.
I don't want to hire a guy who's gonna vomit sausage through his nose. So then you auditioned.
I wasn't even 18 yet, so what are you going to do?
Oh, my God. So you auditioned for the Dead Kennedys in San Francisco.
Yes.
And you, and they're, I mean, that part is like, and they're just like, okay, you're in.
Yeah, it was kind of like, I was, and all those unresolved issues we were talking about earlier, like, you know, just being black and growing up in St. Louis, that it's just like, you're never going to do anything except for clean somebody's freaking floor.
Yeah.
Floor or work at a restaurant or, you know, even in St. Louis, even then, black folks were landscapers still. You know, it wasn't like a big Hispanic trade. Not yet. And you know, of course, we were drug dealers and filled up the prisons. And that was the whole life that I kind of, I mean, you know, there were people who aspired and did everything. You know, there were black teachers and everything, but I just didn't know a lot of them. There wasn't a lot of them in my neighborhood as influences.
Yeah.
You know, the influences I saw were like, you know, my Oscar who shot his brother over here. Or Sparky who grabbed Nella Head by the hair and like, you know, beat her down because, you know, she burnt the bacon or something.
Right,
it was a different time where like, there was no like, there should never be any reason you should hit a woman. It was like that happened all the time. And like there was none of that. I didn't hear that until like, so I was well into living in California for like 10 years.
Right.
I was like,
you did
what?
Not know
wow.
That
I did
not,
not know
that
that was not.
Have an argument.
I was like, wow, well, my mother just got the shit kicked out of her for all the, you know, for, wow, that's, wow.
Yeah.
Thanks for telling me that. And you know, and then I'd go back and visit and kids would go, oh, my father hit me. If my father beat me like they beat you, I'll call Child Protective Custody Services on them and I'll have you thrown in jail. And it's just a different time.
It's a different time. And I mean, like these parents were just, you know, doing what was done to them.
Right. And what,
you know,
working with what they had.
Well, and I thought it was really interesting throughout the book, you sort of talk about your mom and with so much forgiveness.
Yeah.
And I admired that. I thought, I wish I could have that much forgiveness around, like, my dad and all this stuff.
You know, if you want to heal and really heal, like, you know, there's got to be that.
Yeah.
Because there's so much, as much as I think was done to me, there's a lot that I got.
Yeah.
So I got their DNA.
Yeah.
I got this drive, this ADD, HD, dyslexic kid. Wrote a book, okay? I got this drive, this energy, this unrelenting energy. Sure. Unharnessed and letting it go in the wrong direction, it'll get me in a lot of trouble. But if I focus it in the right direction, I can do something amazing.
I
can do anything I want.
And right. Also, was it Uncle Jim?
Uncle Sam.
Uncle Sam. How could I forget that?
You are from Marin County, aren't you? Uncle Jim.
Uncle James. I'm kidding. So,
I had an Uncle James.
See?
Uncle James.
See, I know some things.
You know that.
I know some things. But so, you think you got your musical talent from, you know, came down, like, you know.
I didn't want to, like, I didn't know where it came from.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden, like, when I found out who my biological father was, I'm okay to be, because my biological father, there's three sets of kids and we all had different fathers. My brother had a different father who I never seen. He later on went and visited in Chicago and he has like 20 kids then my father, which gave birth to me and my twin sister, Diane, we never met him. We never met him. And apparently he died and lived not too far away from us. And he was a guitar player.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And so that, and right. Because the father I grew up with, Russell Henley, was like, he was not a guitar player.
Yeah.
And it was just so confusing. And he was very light-skinned.
You thought he was your
natural.
Dad? Until a certain age?
Until, like, literally until I was, like, 30 something. Wow. 30, wow. The first time I tried to get sober in the Chili Peppers, like, I was, like, 27. I tried. And
right.
I want to say cultish, but I didn't even know really, I didn't have the words to say, oh, it was kind of cultish. I was just very afraid. Like, I was afraid to keep doing what I was doing, but it was definitely, I definitely was not ready to like be in a sort of fraternity or like the fellowship.
Right.
Quite yet.
It
was scary to me.
That was, well, I want to go back to that, but I also thought it was really interesting in the book how you talk about how they're like, sorry, man, you know, they kick you out. And you watch, and I read Anthony's book, what they did put up with Anthony and sort of dealing with that.
Right.
You know?
And I knew that, and part of me knew that, but it was, when you're in the grips of, like, heroin addiction, there's just it don't matter what has happened to anybody. Like, Gouda could get her arms chopped off, and I'd be like...
Yeah. And you did have
You know what? I gotta then I can like, you know, wrap your arm up, you know,
right,
and try to sew it back up. Like, let me just get this hit first.
Let me get high first.
Steady my nerve. First. Take the edge off, as they say.
Yeah.
Take the edge off. It's more like put the edge on, isn't it?
Yeah.
The edge of the knife to your bloody throat.
You two never used together, right?
No.
Yeah.
No, we met sober.
Yeah. And that's a good thing.
It's a very good thing.
Yeah.
Because I'm low bottom too. It would have definitely, we would have pulled each other way down.
Well, and you did have a couple relationships that were like that. You know?
Yeah, did.
We were mutual bad influences on each other, kind of.
Uh-huh. A couple. A few of them are just flooding to my mind right now. Yeah.
Well, Sherry was the big one, right?
Yeah, Sherry was a big one, but she actually did clean up and she was one of the first ones to say like her whole thing that she went through when it finally came time for her to get clean and sober and get rid of me, I was kind of shocked that she would say, like, you can't stay here, I can't even help you no more, here, you got to go to Union Station Foundation, which is basically a homeless shelter, and like, I can't, you know, you need to get help. And I just kind of looked with the cow eyes and the sad face, like, why are you not doing?
Right.
Why are you not helping me? You can't just throw me out. This is like, it was like the trauma of getting beaten by my mother, like getting kicked out of the Chili Peppers, getting kicked out of like other bands. That's what it felt like to me.
Right.
And feeling like Ursina when I Ursina slept with some other girl, and that was like a young cat and who didn't know. I was like, well, this is love, right? This is love. I'm thinking it's love.
I know
that everybody in San Francisco is pretty much a whore,
right,
including myself. I mean, I became a whore later. A drunken whore.
Right.
Drunken black punk rock whore. Yeah.
Well, but like, how much do you think that influenced your getting better? The fact that she was like, I'm not going to take this anymore.
The whore
is? H. Belikra.
Hey.
And so where were we? Okay. I wanted to get it. Okay. So you live in San Francisco in this house where the paramedics came 3 times in a week. Like, that's how crazy it was in terms of overdoses and all Mission of that.
And that's that. Again, I was a little frustrated with the editing there because common daily occurrences there were people running in, people running out, people running in, people coming up to buy speed. And the guy who lived in the middle was like one of the bigger speed dealers, and he was like REO speed dealer, San Francisco. His name was, he's dead now.
Yeah.
His name was Sweet. We loved him. He was like Daddy Sweet, but he had that room full of gear and Frank Zappa records and birthday party records and guns and gear and leather jackets and shit piled up to the, you know, that if there was a hoarders back then.
Yeah, he would have been.
And then there was a dumpster across the street too, so.
He would take stuff from there?
He would just, he couldn't not sort of had to look in there and look and like.
That's speed for you, right?
That's speed, you know, that's speed. But, you know, and that wasn't like a big deal. Like, nobody really overdosed on speed. They would just tweak and maybe take apart an engine in the kitchen or something, you know. So
garbage
a car
disposal.
Engine in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Or like, hey, let me fix your stereo. Like 9 hours later.
It's in
know,
pieces.
You know, yeah. And
people get very industrious
And the police would come there for, God, they came there because somebody jumped through the thing trying to get away from, you know, them.
Yeah.
Them. Dun, 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 dun,
the eternal them.
The eternal thems. And the cops were kind of cool. They just knew that our place was kind of rigged like that. But yeah, when people, like me, moved in, and there was like the heroin epidemic. People started doing heroin there. There was like, you know, yeah, near deaths, and the paramedics would come a couple times a week and revive somebody with Narcan and a defibrillator and bring them back to life. But me, when I lived there, I would shoot some coke sometimes, but not really. I wasn't strung out on heroin yet.
Because it's L.A. where you got really strung out.
Yeah.
So you came down here in this kind of school bus thing that was parked next to an apartment, kind of?
Yeah.
And you lived there?
Yeah, my friend Mark was just kind of he was a bit of a hippie himself, a bohemian guy. Mm-hmm. And he really had these dreams of, like, just kind of traveling around the country and parking where he wanted to, and he wanted to start a marble company. He started a marble company and he sold it, and he wanted to open up a hotel in Puerto Rico, and he went and did that as well. And so he just kind of talked me into, like, moving to San Francisco, and I was like, sure, man, Huckleberry, I'll go with you. And we ended up at the Wheaties house. We didn't know it was like the center of the Hollywood hipsters, I guess. Back, we were the hipsters. We were the hipsters. We were the crew.
Right.
Kind of the dropout crew.
And then you moved into Jane's room in Perry Farrell's house.
Yeah. That place had to be cursed.
Yeah.
And, you know, seeing a young Dave Navarro coming around and Steve Perkins with the big hair, that was kind of a sight. They'd never even really heard of the Chili Peppers. And, that was, that was when it really, I remember waking up that morning. That was when, in that room, in that house, is when it really happened. I've been sniffing the China White for a while, and I just woke up, and I was like, oh, God, I feel horrible, man. Oh. And I knew, like, right then, like, knew exactly what was going to fix it.
Right.
I knew exactly what would take away everything, and called up Giuseppe, got some of the China White, and that was like, oh, my God. I'm going to have to do this for the rest of my life. I mean, I didn't think that there was any way that, you know, you're going to be able to, like, oh, I'm going to get off this. I'm just like, I got to get more money.
Right. You know, so I can stay on this forever.
Yeah, so I can, yeah. And it felt fine.
And then,
as soon as I stopped vomiting.
And so, then you joining the Chili Peppers, we kind of did that. Rehab map. I have all these notes. It's just like methadone clinic. DART. DART was a ghetto rehab. Heroin, compartment syndrome in your right leg.
Oh,
that was,
yeah.
Just talk about graphic.
Well, you know, I want to just talk about going to DART for a little while.
Yeah.
That was like a revisiting of St. Louis from a whole different angle. Where, like, I'd moved out and become this rock star and traveled around the world and became, like, a real live rock star.
Yeah.
But, you know, in on a sort of an underground sense. I mean, we weren't like Prince or by any means. And they had never, not really heard. There was a few people there who were mostly staff and a couple of white people. I don't know how they got in this rehab, but they were in there. And the rest was all brothers and sisters, and they were like, Who you think you is? And like, they, it was just like a lesson in beyond ghetto-ness. Like, they were like, really didn't have any, you know, any respect for anybody.
Yeah.
And it was just like, I like it really had to dumb me down. And like, they didn't like the way I talked.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, oh, I must be this some kind of, you think you're like better than us because you talk like that.
Right.
And they're like, you got an accent. Because they were like, this kind of country. And yeah. They like, you know, sort of. Mm-hmm. I was like, I don't know accent. Oh, you think you are. And then they made me like the what is it like? The chore manager, the cleanup, like.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, after you're there for a couple of months, they start giving you these jobs. And you get the job that you hated the other guy for telling you to do, and then you eventually get that job.
Right.
Like, you know, you got to clean up the kitchen, you got to clean the day room, you got to clean the toilets, and then, you know, then they move you upstairs, and they know you're going to be there a little bit longer term, so they'll give you, like, the chore manager. And so you got to go around and check on all these guys and make sure that they have done their chores, and they hate you for it. And some of them are big guys, and they're tough guys, and they've, like, they've been to prison. They just furloughed right out of prison. And even though the rules there are not as tough as prison rules, and the consequences are not as tough, they still had that mentality, like, right. You were the authority guy, and you were the bad guy.
But even though they had to do it too.
They would eventually have to do it. But if people were assholes, they wouldn't give them the job. Oh, that's the thing. So they gave it to me and this old guy Henderson. They give it to me and they give it to him. And
right.
And it was just bullshit. But I mean, just some of the stories about the Grippins and like the shit we would sit in the room and talk about, like how St. Louis has more gold tooths per capita than any other city. Like, how does this conversation get started? Like, we'd be tired all day, weren't allowed to sleep during the day, and we'd get in our room at night, and all of a sudden, suddenly, I'm just kind of lowered down to, like, their level of, like, we're in the room with a bunch of guys, and we're just talking shit. Just talking shit.
Were these guys interested in getting sober at all?
Some of them were, and some of them you just didn't really know, but there wasn't a big heroin epidemic there. They still thought that I was like this. What's wrong with him? Why is he still sick? Like, they'd be fine in a few days. Most of them were either crack or they had some things in St. Louis called T's and blues, whatever that is, you know. But they didn't have a whole lot of heroin there in that city at the time. And I didn't, you know, I was just kind of worried about myself. I didn't really know. I wasn't kind of thinking that, you know, are these guys really trying to get sober? But some people you could tell. Were, and most of them kind of worked there,
right?
You know, so
and
even some of them were a bit shaky and shady. So yeah, we just stay in the room and just talk all this trash, and we really should be sleeping. And I just heard some other horrifying stuff that didn't make it in the book. But you know, like the guy, like Eugene, maybe murdered some people, but we don't really know. But he's hinting around that he did, and you have to like try to go to sleep after this,
right?
And like Jerry Wiggins won't even say, we call him Jay the Wig. He won't even say why have you done 12 years in the pen for what? Oh man, I don't even want to talk about it. I just
so not exactly promises.
Not, yeah.
Morning coffee. No, kind of conversation.
No.
Yeah.
Not promises. Not
Betty Ford.
Not Pathfinders or Pathway or
right.
But you know, then there I was in Malibu Coast treatment too, which was it's a big house, but it was a 6-room sort of deal where it's $30,000 a month, and you got your own private room, and there's hot tubs, and there's healers, and masseuse, and 5-star chef, and it was really small, and I wanted to kill somebody.
I
wasn't going to kill this guy. I was like, you know, and they're you know, they were all rich kids, poor rich kids in Malibu, and they had this whole sense of entitlement.
Yeah.
And you couldn't not talk them out of them. And if they didn't want to get up, they wouldn't get up.
Yeah.
Until like 9 or 10 or...
Yeah.
11.
It's hard, I think, with those rehabs because like you're saying, like some of them are worshiping the bottom dollar, and they're not going to be able to get those clients if they don't allow them to do certain things. So, it's you know, a broken system, I think, in some ways. Can we get into the gross leg thing if I can handle it?
She's squinting her eyes. Anna David is squinting her eyes and gritting her teeth and holding herself too. She's like, looking at the gross thing.
I still have the sausage vomiting out of the nose. I don't handle gross things well. Okay. For my listeners, for you guys, I'm gonna do this.
She's gonna do it.
So you're skin popping.
Get to the bear. Yeah.
No, I'm the kind of person, like, if you started to throw, let's say, like, you were my close friend, you started to throw up, I will throw up too, so I should not be the one to help you.
I can get that sometimes. My, I can't stop swallowing. I'm like, I'm going to blow beats. I'm going to hurl. Watch out. But I usually don't, though.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's really bad. That's and I pat him on the back. Like, oh, you'll be all right. That's right.
So the leg.
Just give me all your money.
So the leg. So it just started to get gross and fall apart.
Okay, well, I'll tell you. Okay. I don't want to tell you everything and then people don't want to buy the book, though.
Hey, you guys, first of all, buy this book.
Buy this book. It's not that expensive.
It's not that expensive. How much is it? It's $18.
$18.
Most are like $24.95, so you're already saving money.
I think it's even $13 if you get it online.
Yeah.
But then there's a small shipping.
Amazon is always running details, and if you have Prime, it's free shipping. So there you go. You just got it for like...
See, I didn't even know that. Prime?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Is it Prime?
You pay like $70-$80 a year, and you get free shipping.
Wow.
You know, my listeners, you guys all have Prime, right?
Come on,
just get this book. I mean,
it's Anna David Show.
What's up? The Anna David Show telling you guys that you got to buy this book. And maybe we'll be able to work out and we do an excerpt on my website for it.
Awesome.
Right?
I'm thinking I'll just come in and do a moth on your website, like a live moth.
What's a moth? Oh, a storytelling thing?
Yes, a storytelling thing where you take something from the book and you act it out and relive it. And there was a tranny story that didn't make it in the book.
Oh. So we could release, like, things that didn't make it in. You're dying to tell a tranny story.
No, I'll tell you the I'm going to give you a brief synopsis of the one leg thing. Okay, so I had gone in, I had shot some Dilaudid in my leg, and it just turned into a big spongy lump.
Yeah.
And it was sort of smoldering and festering, and it smelled like dead dogs, maggots, rotted vomit, and the sewage system in India, which there is none. It's just kind of raw sewage. That's what my legs kind of smelled like. Are you feeling me, people?
Yeah.
Are you picking up what I'm putting down? Huh? Okay, so it stank. And I didn't care. And I was really just ready to die. I didn't care at all. So my neighbors, fortunately my neighbors, I was good friends with them. They saw me and they were like, look, man, these people keep running in and out of your house. I don't know what's going on with you, but you look messed up and you got to go to the hospital. This was after I'd already went for kidney dialysis and all that. Okay. So I go to the hospital and I spend all this time in the waiting room, days. And I finally get in there, and they anesthetize me and put me under, and I kind of come to.
Right.
And, like, the nurses, you know, I come out of the anesthesia because, you know, your tolerance builds up when you're on heroin.
My tolerance built, they didn't know.
But my eyes are wide open, but I could not move. So it was like the night of the living dead, so I couldn't move. And I'm laying there, and these doctors are poking and prodding and picking around, and I'm like, no. See these scars right here on my arm, Anna David?
Yeah.
Right? They cut me open. These were like two little specks. They just sliced it open just to see what was in there. And I'm like, what? No, I'm trying to say, I'm laying on the gurney. I'm trying to say, no, I didn't sign a release for that. That's what I think I'm saying, but I'm not saying anything.
Wait, is that when your leg was shiny? That's, and they just did that?
Yeah. It was like a little bump. It was like a bump. And I've had abscesses before. I think with some antibiotics, it would have just went down.
So you think they were just like, this guy does a lot of drugs? No,
they was just kind of students. They were USC students. They were like, well, doctor, I think we should do this, doctor. Yeah, and the doctor was like, you know, like I was sort of a live cadaver for them to work on.
Ugh.
And that's pretty much. So I came out of it, and they'd done that, and I couldn't feel it because I'm kind of under, but I'm wide awake. And they start pushing the pus out of my leg, and the pus is coming out, and it's flying over. They have these masks on and gloves and like this.
Were they
shield.
Like, ew? Do you remember that part?
I remember looking at the guy and he's squinting in his face and he's got his nose turned up and his face looks like a Sharpay and he's just like pushing. Like I could feel the pressure of him pushing and the pus was literally squirting over his head on his scrubs. On his face
this
shield.
This is a diet show because you'll like, never eat again.
It was like really thick sperm or something. It was just really nasty. It was nasty all over his. Yeah, but it didn't smell like sperm. Probably smelled good compared to this.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
The next day they come around to my room doing the rounds and they can. Well, this is Mr. D. Henley and he's a blah 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 male and we extracted. Approximately a liter of pus from his left thigh. And I was just kind of like, then they left the room. You know, it was because the doctors do their rounds.
Yeah.
They left the room and I was like, I thought, what did he just say? A liter of, it didn't even register me like a liter, like a pet, like, hold
yeah,
on.
Yeah, how much
hold
is
on.
A,
like
a,
like, that's a two of these, but
two of those,
it's two of those.
Two water bottles worth of pus.
This is what, 12 ounces?
This is 500 milliliters.
500 milliliters.
It's a lot of pus.
Ugh. Whole lot of pus.
God.
And then I stayed there for 2 weeks and God, it was another cast of characters. It's like when you're in that, like you meet these people who just don't want. They have no idea about really trying to get clean or sober. There was a guy running around chewy, and he was gathering money from people so he can go out and get heroin for them and shoot it up in their IVs so they could, you know, get high. And apparently he had full-blown AIDS, and I heard it through the wire, and I was just like, no, man, I'm good. I'm going to rehab, I would tell him, you know. And he shared it with a bunch of people. And, you know, he would put it in the spoon, cook it up, use his old dirty needle, stick it in there first. So now the whole thing's contaminated.
Yeah.
And then all the guys have to pull theirs out of there, too.
So did they all get sick?
I don't know if they all got sick or not. I didn't hang around really fine. They were still there in the room. I mean, you didn't know, like, that day.
Exactly,
like,
yeah.
But, it was just that close, you know, inches, seconds and inches away from. But I was kind of like, the doc, I'm like, we're in the biggest dope house in the world, man. Like, what are you guys doing? Just grumble a little bit. Talk to the doctor. Grumble. Talk to cry. Hell, there was this old black dude in there. He was like, oh, 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 ah, ah, ah. And then he was like, yeah. I need some Dilaudid. I don't need Dilaudid. I need number 10.
Oh, God. Oh. He knew the drill.
And like, and doctor was like, okay, here. And he was like, in his little wheelchair, like,
yeah. You don't need to go for
cigarette?
Heroin. Yeah.
I was like, that's how you do it. All
right.
That's how you do it.
All right, more direct route.
What about Chewy? Like, yeah.
Okay, well, so this is a crazy life. You guys, if you don't buy this book, then I don't know what's wrong with you.
I don't know.
I think, D.H., thank you so much.
You know,
I
skipped over a lot of SSI, Dead Kennedys, and acid stuff, but it's all there. It's all in
the
book.
It's all in the book. You got to buy it.
You will not regret it.
No, and we might do an excerpt, which will tempt you even further. But thank you so much. Thank you for sharing this.
You're very welcome, Anna David. Thanks for having me on the show.
Garuda.
Thank you.
My favorite Garuda I've ever met. Thanks, you guys, so much.